Now, today I want to complete the series that I've been going through difficult Old Testament scriptures. And these are difficult from several vantage points. One, because modern-day scholars regard the original as obscure simply because we don't understand it. But it's like if we were talking in our modern-day English language today, and then 2,000 years later somebody's reading something we wrote, they might have a difficult time understanding exactly what we mean because of the various nuances and shades of meaning and how it was implied in context and all that type of thing. So some of these difficult scriptures are based on that viewpoint. Others, simply because they may give the wrong connotation if people misconstrue what they really meant. Others show more the thinking of God's mind, and we don't always understand that when we read it. So I will try to complete this series today and cover some of these difficult ones here that lend themselves to those questions. Today we will begin in Numbers, the 21st chapter. And we'll see the incident here that it just needs an explanation because of the various ideas that commentators and theologians have come up with as an attempt to explain why God did, why he instructed Moses to do what he did here. But this has to do with the Israelites when they journeyed, as we read here in verse 4, from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Eden, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. So it was very difficult traveling, adverse in every way. And the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. Very difficult terrain, no doubt, to negotiate, and various hardships were encountered. But here's what happened, though. And the people spake against God and against Moses. Now, they just allowed themselves to get carried away with this because they not only criticized Moses, they criticized God right along with it. And they were saying, in effect, see, the people spake against God and against Moses, wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loathes this light bread. So they were complaining because of the manna, and there was a shortage of water, and they were very uncomfortable, and so they took their spite out on God, which people seem to always have a tendency to do. They never want to hold themselves accountable. They always blame God for what happens. Now, how did God respond to this? And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. Probably the biggest complainers. So God was so disgusted with them that he just saw to it that some of these people didn't go any further, which is probably what they well deserved. Now, the rest of them, of course, realized the seriousness of the problem. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against thee." Which was absolutely true. So they were acknowledging and repenting of what they had done here. "Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us." And Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said to Moses, now here's God's instruction to Moses. And this is where people begin to come up with all kinds of ideas as to why God did what he did. And I think the answer is very simple. We don't have to overcomplicate anything, really. The Lord said to Moses, "Make thee a fiery serpent and set it upon a pole, and it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, he shall live." And Moses made a serpent of brass and put it upon a pole, and it came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. Now, if you read various commentators, their answer will be, well, this was a type of Christ. I doubt it. I don't think Christ would be represented by a serpent. If anybody would be represented by the serpent, it would be the devil. But really, it isn't a type per se at all. Because the answer, I think, is very clear. If you look over here in Deuteronomy 32, God has the power to take life, does he not? Is that not his prerogative? Well, if God has a prerogative to take life, he also has a prerogative to give life. After all, is he not God? So, as we read here in Deuteronomy 32, verse number 39, "See now that I am he, and there is no God with me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand." What God was showing these people, if he had the power to send death by means of a serpent, he also had the power to give life. by a symbol of a serpent. So what God was really showing here by this entire example is his omnipotent power and his authority to do as he sees fit under any given circumstance. So we needn't be concerned about what kind of type and this type of thing represents. I don't think it represents that at all. It simply shows God's power to kill and to make alive, in one case by the serpent and in the other case by the symbol of the serpent as a brass serpent. Now, one thing, of course, as people always tend to do, they did misuse this serpent. So let's go to 2 Kings chapter 18. In fact, I'm really wondering whether or not this is a basis for the Aesculapius symbol found in modern-day medicine. In any respect, notice here in 2 Kings 18, we read that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz of Judah, began to reign in verse number 1, and we read in verse 3 of 2 Kings 18 that he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that David his father did. He removed the high places and brake the images and cut down the groves and brake in pieces of brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan. So they made an idol out of this serpent of brass, and this righteous king destroyed it, and rightfully so. But it does demonstrate God's prerogative and God's power. If he's able to send servants to kill, he can also use a symbol of a serpent in the form of a brazen serpent to save life. It's his prerogative. The next one is in Judges 11. Just by way of rehearsal, Jephthah, as we read here in Judges 11, verse 1, the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor. And he was the son of a harlot. And Gilead begat Jephthah. This was a very prominent man from those Israelites that dwelled on the east side of the Jordan River. But this son, unfortunately, was born under dire circumstances or bad circumstances. The rest of the brothers did not want him to inherit anything, so he was kicked out. And he gathered around him various men, and he became, over a period of time, a notable warrior, a champion, and as it says here, a mighty man of valor. Now, in the course of time, the Ammonites decided they wanted that territory back. They somehow felt it belonged to them, so they decided to take it by force. The Israelites, in panic, needed a leader, so they came to Jephthah. And at first he scorned them because he said, "You didn't have any consideration and concern for me when my brethren kicked me out. Why are you coming running to me now?" And they said, "Well, you know, we needed a leader and a champion." And they prevailed upon him, and so he decided, all right, he would head an army and he would fight these Ammonites. So we read here, picking it up in verse number 29, "The Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah." So he was inspired of God. In fact, if you read here in chapter 12, verse number 7, following this, he judged Israel 6 years. So he was one of the judges. And he passed over Gilead and Manasseh, and passed over Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed over unto the children of Ammon. And Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord, and said, "If thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering." Now, the assumption is that we see here that, as we'll continue in the story here, because the daughter was the first one to appear at the door, then he offered up for a burnt offering. So we read here in verse 32, "Jephthah passed over into the children of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord delivered them into his hands, and he smote them." So I won't read all the details here, but he did subdue them. And then in verse 34, "Jephthah came to Mizpah unto his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with timbrels and with dances, and she was his only child. Beside her he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass when he saw her that he rent his clothes and said, 'Alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low, and thou art one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back.'" And she said unto him, My father, if thou hast opened thy mouth unto the Lord, do to me according to that which has proceeded out of thy mouth, forasmuch as the Lord hath taken vengeance for thee of thine enemies, even of the children of Ammon. And she said unto her father, Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go up and down upon the mountains and bewail my virginity, I and my fellows. And he said, Go. And he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her companions and bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. And it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow which he had vowed, and she knew no man. And it was a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Japheth the Gileadite 4 days in a year. Now people read that, and the assumption is that he sacrificed his daughter. Now there's a number of things wrong with that concept, as we'll see from the translation itself. But just from reading the background of the whole incident here, you'll find, number one, that Jephthah was very well versed in the history of Israel, and he was an honorable man, no doubt. He laid out the entire, I won't go through the whole story here, but in essence he said, you know, that your claim to this isn't valid, and he gives the whole history as to why it wasn't valid and why it belonged to Israel, and they were overstepping their bounds and demanding it. So he was knowledgeable about events, about sequence of events and chronology, and he was also aware of the time, and he was also aware that God was the one that had given them that land. So very obviously he was an honorable man and certainly was aware of God. Furthermore, we read here, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. And then we read in chapter 12, verse 7, he judged Israel 6 years. Do you think the Israelites would permit a man to sit over them, ruling and judging them, who had been a man who participated in human sacrifices? Not in that time period. Later on, when the kings gained control and power, some of them did it, and they got away with it. But at this stage in the game, it's hardly possible that the children of Israel, because, you know, a judge just didn't decide he was just going to be a judge, and he became a judge. He became a judge because all the heads gathered together and selected him to be their judge, a republic form of government. For all the heads of the tribes gathered together and gave their approval. Those are a number of reasons why it is highly unlikely that he sacrificed his daughter. Now, let's look at the translation itself. Your marginal rendering is a great help if you have one, because notice what it says here in verse 31. Then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, or I will offer it for a burnt offering. That's what my marginal rendering says. It doesn't say and, it says or. Now I know it's the Hebrew vav, which is often translated and, but it can also be translated or just as well. Now there's one other thing here, as the Hebrew interlinear shows here, the latter part of the verse, I will offer it up instead of a burnt offering. The word for, green, takes to mean instead of. And it could just as well mean then, it shall surely be the Lord's. And it could say either and or will, whatever the case may be, I'll offer it instead of a burnt offering. So when the daughter was the first to come out to meet him, very obviously he was not going to offer her as a burnt offering. Now, there's something else here we should recognize. Notice verses 37 and 38 and 39. What was she bewailing here? She said, I will bewail my virginity. In other words, she was not going to be able to be married. And then notice it again here in verse 39. He vowed the vow which he had vowed, and she knew no man. And then notice verse number 40. That the daughters of Israel went yearly, and you see the word lament, we'll check your marginal rendering once again. Lament here should be translated, went yearly to talk with the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in a year. Or as it can also be translated, to praise or to tell again of. But there's no implication here from anywhere that he offered her as a burnt offering. And if he were a righteous man, and he was a judge of Israel for 6 years, and he certainly was very much aware of God and even made a vow to God, then obviously he was not a man who had been practicing the heathen practices of offering burnt offerings and offering his daughter as a sacrifice. I think that is a very highly unlikely conclusion to this whole section here. Now we'll go to another one here. This is in 1 Samuel 31. I will read from 1 Samuel 31 and also 1 Chronicles 10 because they both say the same thing. And then show you what is believed by some to be a contradiction. Now remember, the Bible is written in such a way, as the Bible says, it's line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little and there a little. So not everything is found in one place. And then the second thing we must recognize is that when the Bible really appears to be contradicting, it isn't contradicting at all, it is augmenting and adding to. It's much like you read in the gospel accounts, one account will say this is Jesus of Nazareth, and another one will say this is the King of the Jews. And when you put them all together, what was said under the sign that Pilate wrote is just, this is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. So we have a similar incident here, because in the one case, we'll read through it, but I'll mention it here in advance. In the one case, Saul was to have killed himself by falling upon his sword, and in another instance, a young Amalekite killed him. So what really took place here? All right, we'll pick it up in 1 Samuel 31, verse 1. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, Saul's sons. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. So he had some arrows stuck in him. Then said Saul unto his armor bearer, draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took his sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him. So Saul died, and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men that same day together. Now the similar account is found in 1 Chronicles 10. 1 Chronicles 10, beginning in verse 1, the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard after Saul and after his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was wounded of the archers. Then said Saul to his armor bearer, draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. So Saul took his sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon the sword and died. Now we have a problem that arises here in 2 Samuel chapter 1, and beginning here in verse 1. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Ziklag, it came even to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. And David said to him, from whence cometh thou? And he said unto him, out of the camp of Israel am I escaped. And David said unto him, how went the matter? I pray thee, tell me. He answered, that the people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also. And David said to the young man that told him, how knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan his son be dead? And the young man said, as I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called unto me, and I answered, here I am. And he said to me, who art thou? And I said, I am an Amalekite. He said unto me again, stand, I pray thee, upon me, and slay me, for anguish has come upon me, because my life is yet whole within me. So I stood upon him and slew him, because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was on his arm and brought him hither unto my lord. And David took hold of the clothes and rent them, and likewise and so forth they mourned. Now what happened? Well, when you put the count together, it's very obvious what happened. Saul was sore wounded, and he desired to die. He asked his armor bearer to kill him. His armor bearer refused to do it. So Saul fell upon his sword. The young Amalekite came on the scene. Saul was still alive, and he said, slay me. So the young Amalekite killed Saul. And then when the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he killed himself too. That's the only logical explanation you can have. It isn't contradicting. You weave the two accounts together. You see, the armor bearer didn't kill himself until he saw that Saul was dead. And Saul didn't die until he was killed by the Amalekite. So the whole account fit together then makes sense. And then the result was, as we read here in 2 Samuel 1, verse 12, they mourned and wept and fasted until even for Saul and for Jonathan and his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man that told him, "Whence art thou?" And he answered, "I am the son of a stranger in Amalekite." And David said to him, "How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And so David called upon one of the young men and said, "Go and fall upon him," and he smote him that he died, because he slew the Lord's anointed. You see, David had enough respect and fear for the office that God placed on Saul that David himself refused to lay a hand on Saul, even though he had ample opportunity to do so on more than one occasion. David could have slain him himself easily. But he knew that in due time God would take care of it, and it wasn't any man's prerogative to do it. And so when this young man did that, obviously knowing better, he did deserve the death sentence. But you see, the case is that there is no contradiction. The two accounts jive together, and it shows the detail of how Saul died. Now the next example is in 2 Samuel 5. And I'm only reading this because it seems difficult. If you read the commentators, they'll all tell you that it really isn't obscure. It simply is the fact that a lot of times you can pick something up and read it, and you can read the words, but you don't really understand what it means. You don't really get the gist of it. In fact, it could be open to several interpretations. And in this particular case here, the way the King James does the job on it, it is obscure and difficult to understand. Remember, David was made king over all Israel. We find this in 2 Samuel 5. And then in verse number 6, the king and his men went to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land. Now remember, there were peoples who were originally there who had never been driven out. The Jebusites were a case in point. And they lived in this citadel called Jebus, later on to became known as Jerusalem, because that's where David built his city and so forth. And they had an impregnable citadel there that could not seemingly be conquered. And once David became king, he decided that that citadel would be taken. And so they went to take it. Well, very obviously, the Jebusites knew they were coming there for a bad purpose. At least from their viewpoint, it was a bad purpose. So we read here, "They spake to David, saying, Except you take away the blind and the lame, you shall not come in hither," thinking David cannot come in hither. Now, I think we'll see the clearest rendition of it here in the Living Bible in just a moment. "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, the same as the city of David. And David said on that day, Whosoever getteth up to the gutter and smiteth the Jebusites, and the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Wherefore they said, The blind and the lame shall not come into the house." Now that isn't perfectly clear as to what that is meant there. But there's one other account we want to get here in 1 Chronicles 11, which will help somewhat, and then we'll get the Living Bible on it. 1 Chronicles 11. Picking it up here in verse 4. "And David and all Israel went to Jerusalem," which is Jebus, or Jebus, "where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. And the inhabitants of Jebus said to David, Thou shalt not come hither. Nevertheless, David took the castle of Zion, which is the city of David." Now, you've seen enough medieval movies to know what it's like to try to conquer a castle. You usually see armed men on the walls, and then you find men trying to use ladders to climb up and scale the walls, and they get pushed down and they get hot scalding water poured on them and rocks dropped on their heads, and you know, it isn't a pleasant experience. Now, he didn't utilize this method though, because there was a certain way he could get in there that was a lot easier, and we'll see that in just a moment. But notice what happened here. David said, "Whosoever smiteth the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain." So Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first and was chief. Now, there was a reason Joab was commander-in-chief. There was something about Joab that made him a superb fighter and a warrior. He had a mean streak in him that wouldn't quit. And in two or three instances in his career, David was actually almost aghast at Joab's mean streaks. But I'll tell you, he was a fighting man, if there ever was one, probably the General Patton of his day, because he took that city. Now, you get it here in the Living Bible, and you'll see it a little bit better here as to what the translation, probably the most accurate one, probably really is, because this does capture the sense very well. We read here in 2 Samuel 5, beginning here in verse number 6 in this Living Bible, David now led his troops to Jerusalem to fight against the Jebusites who lived there. "You will never come in here," they told him. "Even the blind and lame could keep you out." For they thought they were safe. So they were just hurling insults is what they were doing. But David and his troops defeated them and captured the stronghold of Zion and called the city David. When the insulting message from the defenders of the city reached David, he told his troops, "Go up through the water tunnel into the city and destroy those, quote, lame and blind Jebusites," unquote. How I hate them. And that is the origin of the saying, "Even the blind and lame could conquer you." So there evidently was derived from this incident some little proverb or saying that became common usage, you know, "Even the blind and the lame can conquer you." Perhaps as though it was a play on words, a reversed meaning of what was intended by what the Jebusites said. So that probably gives the best meaning for it. And so when you read some of these passages like this, I think just with a little bit of persistence, it isn't that difficult to find out what they really meant. Now let us go to 1 Kings 19. This particular incident here seems strange because of the way that it was carried out. But keep in mind that God often spoke and revealed himself in various ways that we're not exactly familiar with or attuned to. And sometimes vivid, literal experiences are more effective than just straight talk. The background here in 1 Kings 19 is found in the previous chapters, and we will recall that Elijah had this duel with the priests of Baal upon Mount Carmel. Remember that? And he kept mocking them and telling them to call upon their God to perform his miracle and burn up the sacrifice, and nothing availed. And then when God intervened for Elijah, not only did the fire burn up the sacrifice, even the water and everything that was around it that had been poured on it. And then Elijah took the 400 priests of Baal down and they were slain. Remember that incident? So here now Elijah fighting for God and upholding the truth in a whole nation of idolaters seemed to be standing alone. Now what happened? Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done. This is 1 Kings 19 verse 1. "And withal, how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this same time." No doubt she had full intentions of doing it. After all, she pretty well ruled the roost in that family. It's like the saying goes, it's a sad home where the rooster is silent and the hen crows. And this happened to be one of those instances. So, rightfully, Elijah was concerned. So what happened? When he saw that, he arose and went for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belonged to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die. He was all discouraged. Here his whole effort seemingly had come to an end. Even though he had rid the land of those prophets, here he hadn't solved the problem with this queen, this idolatrous queen. His life was in danger. Everything he had done had come to naught. He was rightfully discouraged. He requested for himself that he might die, and said, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my father's." You know, they were all idolaters, weren't they? The whole nation was a nation of idolaters at that time. And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baking on the coals and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drank and laid him down again. And the angel of the Lord came again the second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee." And he arose and did eat and drink and went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the Mount of God. It's as though he were impelled and driven there under the inspiration of God's Spirit, but by the strength of that single meal, he went 40 days and 40 nights. And he came thither unto a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him and said unto him, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" Now remember, Mount Horeb, I believe it's the same mount where the Ten Commandments were given, the Mount of God. And he said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts. For the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." So he was still very discouraged, fraught with a particular set of circumstances that had arisen over his attempt to try to restore the nation back to common sense. And seemingly it failed. So what did God do? He said, "Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and brake in pieces of rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake." Here Elijah had seen these incredible manifestations of God's power, and yet had not seen God directly. Now there is one thing in the pagan world that we should be aware of, and that is, in the pantheistic religions, people worship various manifestations of nature. They may worship lightning, they may worship thunder, they may worship rain, they may worship clouds, they may worship a volcano, whatever the case may be. They think that's God. And God is clearly showing here that these are only manifestations of God's power, that God is above and beyond this kind of thing. "And after the earthquake, of fire, and the Lord was not in the fire." Now, do you think God could have the power to destroy the nation of Israel and the whole world by that means, or by the means of either an earthquake or a wind or a fire? He certainly could if he chose to. In fact, he's going to destroy the world the last time in a fire. That's what the lake of fire is all about. In fact, an earthquake is going to be so powerful in the last days, right at the time God manifests his power, the Bible says that every mountain and every island will move out of their place. And the greatest men in the earth and the most powerful ones are the most secure. The Bible says they're going to run and hide in the holes in the rocks and hide in the clefts of the mountains, and they're going to say, "Hide us, take us, deliver us from the face of this one." A day's coming. God has the power to manifest himself that way if he chooses. He isn't choosing to do this, so, as he's telling Elijah. What's he going to do instead? "And after the fire, a still small voice," or "a sound of gentle stillness," as the Hebrew reads. What a contrast. Now, it is out of this gentle stillness that God manifests himself. You see, he didn't manifest himself with the wind and the earthquake and the fire, but with this still small voice, he manifested himself. And what happened? "It was so when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entering of the cave. And behold, there came a voice in him and said, 'What doest thou here, Elijah?' And he said, 'I've been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek to take my life.'" Now the Lord does manifest himself and reveals, whether he manifested himself visibly, he did reveal to Elijah now what he wanted. He didn't do that previously. Here's what he said. "Go, return on the way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when thou comest, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shall thou anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room. And it shall come to pass that him that escapes the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapes the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. Yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth which has not kissed him. So what is God showing here? God is showing that he is going to punish Israel, all right, for their idolatry. But he's going to do it through these human agencies, as God often does, that he prefers to handle and correct men by rational reason, sense, and by ascending of human instruments rather than manifesting his great power, which he could do it. And so when you read the rest of the history here of what happened, you'll see that Hazael precipitated a terrible slaughter upon the Israelites in a war. You find that Jehu slew that whole family of Ahab and took control, and even had descendants that controlled for some time after that because of his zeal for God. And he also was responsible for wiping out Baalism in Israel. And then Elisha himself performed a number of miracles, some which did involve slaying some rather obstreperous people. So God did, by this example, show that it is not God's way to destroy, per se, or coerce, but rather to use rationale and preaching and human instrumentalities to carry out his will. And Elisha, as we know then, was replaced later by Elisha, who carried his mantle in his stead. Now we have one more, and this is in 1 Chronicles 21. And in 2 Samuel 24, I think probably 2 Samuel 24 is the best of the two to refer to here. But we'll read 1 Chronicles 21, 1 first, because it does specifically state what agency was used by God to carry out this punishment upon Israel. 1 Chronicles 21, 1, "And Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel." So who was really the one that was behind it? Satan was provoking David. Now you go back to 2 Samuel, and we see why. 2 Samuel 24, verse 1, "And again the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel." So really what was being done here, even at the behest of David, because David was the agency by which it had to be done, nevertheless it was a punishment upon Israel, as it says here, "And he moved David against them to say, go and number Israel and Judah." Now what's wrong with that? Well, for one thing, what happens when people sit back and count all of their resources and their numbers? Do they have any concern and consideration and trust in God? How many rich men, really rich men, fear and tremble before God? You ever known any? Not very many. When they think they have all the wealth they need, or they have all the power they need, or they have all the security they need, or they have all the forces they need, they have all the armaments they need, they don't have any need for God. They get haughty, and they get full of pride and vanity. Now remember, however, David was provoked by Satan to do this. Now why was God angry with Israel? Well, go back to previous chapters here in 2 Samuel. You can pick it up here, beginning in 2 Samuel 15, with Absalom's conspiracy. And following Absalom's revolt, his conspiracy and revolt, there was another one. There was a revolt under Sheba. You find that here in 2 Samuel 20. And in both cases, the majority of the people sided in and joined with these rebels. God was utterly disgusted with the nation of Israel because they were not willing to accept his king and the house of David that he had placed over Israel. They, in their own self-willed, rebellious way, they wanted to set up their own leaders. They finally succeeded because God became disgusted with the lineage of David in Solomon and said, "I'm going to rend 10 tribes from you. You'll only retain 2 because of my promise to David." But here was an incident that was on, both of these incidents were uncalled for, and these people were revolting against David, and God was utterly disgusted with the nation of Israel. Now, the next thing is, whenever some political leader starts some kind of a big program, doesn't everybody jump on the bandwagon? Well, everybody but me. I don't jump on it. In fact, when this latest gimmick came up, you know, going to jack up the prices on the license plates about 3 times, I read that, I saw red. Well, I guess a lot of other politicians did too. They were smart enough to know it's not the wise thing to do in an election year. I'm glad that thing fell flat on its face. Anyway, people all jump on the bandwagon, don't they? They get all excited about it. Do you think the Israelites as a whole were excited about it? And boy, were they thrilled by what was going on here and absolutely forgetting God and everything. No wonder God was angry with Israel. Now, Joab saw that it was an unwise thing to do, and he argued with David till he was red in the face not to do it. But David was king, and he prevailed, and so Joab had to carry out the sentence and take the census. But then after it happened, what happened? David's heart smote him. After that, he had numbered the people. And David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in that I have done, and now I beseech thee, take away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have done very foolishly. He did realize it, because it leads to the wrong thing. You know, it's just like people that want to be rich. You know, they just think if they could just be wealthy and have a lot of money and just have anything they want, they'd be happy. I can tell you nothing would be further from the truth. The Bible says those that will be rich get themselves into a snare, into many harmful and hurtful lusts that drown men in perdition. You know, when you find out how great your power is, you know, that may not be good for you. And it certainly was not good for Israel. So God sent a prophet then, Gad, and he gave him a choice. Gad came to David and told him and said, shall 7 years of famine come unto thee of the land, or wilt thou flee 3 months before thine enemies while they pursue thee, or that there be 3 days pestilence in the land? Now advise and see what answer I shall return to him that sent me. So the whole incident that occurred here was provoked because of Israel's rebellion against God's form of government, God's servant. Now, David was wise, however, to recognize that if you're going to be punished, you're far better off to be punished by God than by man, because I can tell you, men are merciless, or they can be. David said to Gad, I am in a great strait. Let us now fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercies are great, and let me not fall into the hand of man. So the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from the morning even to the time appointed, and there died of the people from Dan even to Beersheba 70,000 men, probably the biggest complainers and the biggest rebels. Well, they were punished for their sins. But you see, God had to provide a real issue. You know, it's like a child sometimes. Your child will do something wrong, and you don't, for some set of circumstances or reasons, you don't punish him right for that particular thing at that time. But you watch. You watch for the next incident to occur, because then you're going to lower the boom. And that's exactly what God was doing here. He was waiting for an incident now where he could lower the boom, and he lowered the boom on him. So you see, the whole incident here occurred because David was being used as a leader to precipitate this movement to take the census. Everybody jumped on the bandwagon. God was utterly disgusted with them for their former sins and punished them accordingly. So I think that when you look at all of these texts that I've given here today in the light of the various contexts and the circumstances that surrounded them, they're not all that difficult to understand, and they do lend a lot of clarity and meaning into how God's mind operates and works.